According to my phone, it is now 4:10, so we will ignore the clock over there. I've gone through the forms on office hours for both classes, and the best two times appear to be noon Tuesday and noon Thursday, with scores of 7 and 6, I think, people who couldn't make it. So to start with, my office hour is going to be noon on Tuesday. There may be a problem occasionally if there's a lunch thing event that I've got to go to, a faculty meeting or something, and if so, I will try to put a note up on the web page shifting it from Tuesday to Thursday. And if it turns out that you people are so eager to come in and talk to me that isn't enough time, I will make it Tuesday and Thursday, and if that doesn't do it, we'll find some other times. If it isn't convenient for you, you can always email and we can set up some other appointment as convenient, or we can just discuss stuff by email. All right? Most people seem to think email was adequate. The recording of Thursday's class is now up on the webpage. It's only an audio recording. I'm afraid that's all we're going to get this year. And I am recording this class even as we speak. I hope. I think. If any of you find broken links on the webpage, please email me about them. I was looking and haven't found any at the moment since what I found earlier. I think I would now like to start with any questions you have about class mechanics. Are there any questions about things like papers and the fact that we're going to be discussing papers later on and so forth? No. All right. The next question is, do you have any questions about the previous class? The next one is, do you have any questions about the reading for this class? I suggest that as a general rule, when you're doing your reading, I don't care if you take notes about what's in it, whether you want it on paper or in your head, but that if there are things that puzzle you, questions that are raised, things you don't understand, things that don't make sense, make notes, and then you can bring them up in class, because I'd really rather be talking about things that people in the audience are interested in than just things that I'm interested in or that are repeating what you've already read in the class. Sort of the strategy is to spend as little of possible time as possible telling you things that you should already know, and as much time as possible on more interesting things than that. What I'm planning to do today is first to go over the material about the gypsies relevant to what you've just read, and if we have time at the end of that, there are a few things left over that I was thinking of talking about in the previous class and never got to that I will cover. And I want to start with one point that isn't really discussed, but that struck me reading it, and that is that the normal marriage age for gypsies traditionally is between 9 and 14 for women. And that is probably at this point illegal in every state in the U.S. I think for a while in New Hampshire you could marry at 14. On the other hand, it is not all that unusual, historically speaking, that Jewish law, which we'll get to later, if I remember correctly, a woman was an adult essentially at, I think, 12 and a half. Could be married earlier than that, but if she was married earlier than that, she could cancel the marriage when she became an adult if she wanted to. One of the things that is occasionally pointed out by people who want to say bad things about Islam is that Muhammad married Aisha, I think, when she was 9. And I believe tradition has that the marriage was consummated when she was fairly young. I'm not sure whether literally 9 or not, but you certainly see discussions of this sort of thing in Islamic law. And our society is very negative on especially young women either marrying or having sex. To some extent, that's a recent development. As I say, New Hampshire, 14 used to be, and in general, minimum ages for marriage have been going up over the last few decades in the U.S. I'm not quite sure why, but it does raise some interesting issues in terms of cross-cultural reactions that, in effect, from the standpoint of American law, probably a majority of traditional Jewish and Islamic marriages would count as statutory rape.
Cross-culturally and throughout history, do you find that a younger marriage age is more common than what we have?
Certainly, that is not that everybody marries young, but my impression is that it is historically very common that basically the point at which you go through puberty is the point at which you become marriageable. That in the case of Islamic men, I think it's 13 and a half and three pubic hairs, if I correctly remember the legal definition in traditional Jewish law. And I don't remember the details in Islamic law. But there is a sense in which we tend to think of other cultures as less tolerant than we are. And that's partly because anything we're intolerant about, obviously you ought to be intolerant about, so that doesn't count. Whereas anything we're tolerant about, we object to other people being intolerant about. And I think that's one example where it's actually the other way around, where our rules are more stringent than those of at least many other societies. I was just noticing a news story about somebody in Texas who got off with a small, relatively short sentence for, quote, raping a 14-year-old. When you read the story, it's perfectly clear that what it was a consensual relationship with somebody who was below the age of consent. In our society, we tend to mix two very different things, namely sex with people who are illegally young versus actually forced sex. Which is also sort of interesting. Anyway, I thought that was a point that was worth mentioning. As I say, it does come up if you read attacks on Islam in online and such. So let me talk a bit about the elaborate system of pollution, what I like to describe as Orthodox Judaism on steroids, in the Gypsy system. And the question is why? All right, you've got these rules about the top half of the body is pure, the bottom half is impure, you've got to have all sorts of restrictions on what you do and what you wash and things of that sort. And I'm curious whether people have any plausible guesses about what's going on with this system. Is it just sort of random accident? Yeah.
Well, as the author suggested in the beginning, he said it had a lot to do with the transmission of disease, which was something that was of great concern to the 50s and their nomadic lifestyle.
So that's one possible answer. This is the same issue. The issue often comes up if you think about kosher laws, that a good deal of the kosher laws are weird in the sense they don't actually follow from the sources. As you may know, one of the kosher laws is that you are not to eat meat and milk at the same meal. And what that comes out of is a passage in the Old Testament that says you are not to eat a kid boiled in his mother's milk. And then it got expanded by the legal scholars way beyond that. And everybody takes it for granted now, as all Orthodox Jews do, that that's part of the rules. So one explanation is that it's functional, and the explanation one sees for the rule against pork, though I'm not sure how far in Judaism, and for that matter Islam, is that pork transmits trichinosis, but it doesn't transmit it if it's cooked, and so why not have a rule which says you just have to cook it, which seems to satisfy the requirement, and then you get your tasty pork and bacon that way. And similarly on the hygiene, some of it might make sense for that. On the other hand, the hands are allowed to move between the pure and the impure, and that certainly is a way of spreading disease.
As far as the pork is concerned, another explanation could be the animal itself, the habits of the animal itself, and I've heard a lot about how pigs are considered dirty because they eat everything and they bathe in filth and...
Mm-hmm. Could be, yeah. Let me suggest a different kind of explanation. Part of the reason I originally came to Santa Clara was that there was a professor in the econ department, Larry Iannacone, who came to where I was then and gave a really interesting talk, and that sort of interested me at the school. He's not here anymore. He went off to George Mason University. And I've been complaining for years that the people at George Mason just don't understand property rights. They keep stealing my colleagues. The talk I heard from Larry, I should say, is an economist whose specialty is economics of religion. And what's sort of interesting about that is that, as far as I can tell, he is also a seriously believing Christian. So he has, in effect, two different religions, one of which is economics and one of which is some form of Protestant Christianity, and he is, in some sense, turning one on the other, which is sort of an interesting question. He's a very smart and interesting guy. And the talk he gave was about why some religious groups, some sects, have what seem to an economist like inefficient rules. that it makes sense that you would say if you're going to be a Catholic, you should have it tithe 10% of your income to the church. The church can use that money to spread the religion and help the poor and so forth. And similarly, Islamic law has a set of religiously required taxes, which are essentially like a tithe. But why do you have rules? One example might be the meat and milk, which looks like it's just an inconvenience for the people involved and nobody gets anything out of. Why do you have rules such as Hare Krishna's shaving their heads, which makes them look weird to everybody else, and again, doesn't seem to achieve anything? And there are a lot of others. If you look at, say, Mormons would be another group. And his explanation was that the function of these rules is to reduce the interaction between members of the group and other people, and that there's a reason for this, that there are a variety of sort of in-group public goods which work for groups that aren't too large. So if you say you would like to have a society where if something terrible happens, if you die, somebody will make sure that your widow and kids don't starve. Well, one way of doing it is you have a small religious group. People know each other. The fact that I helped out your widow and kids will give me credit with other members of the group, and they will help out me or my survivors if I die. You can think of a bunch of ways, sort of informal coordination, cooperation within a group, but which tends to break down the bigger the group is, the more anonymous people are. So Larry's argument was that one function of these rules is to make interaction outside of the group harder, and therefore to draw boundary lines that result in the larger fraction of your interaction being in-group interaction. So that if you are a Orthodox Jew, you really can't go to dinner at a non-Jewish house unless they're willing to go to a noticeable amount of trouble to fit your rules. That's true to, I guess, only a slightly lesser degree if you're a serious believing Muslim because of the dietary rules. If you're a Hare Krishna, other people are going to think you look really funny and crazy, and they'll be less likely to associate with you, and so forth. And so that was sort of Larry's explanation. And he then went on to say, you know, can we get any interesting predictions out of this? And his argument went as follows. He said you can think about different religious groups as more or less sect-like, where a sect-like group is a group that's got a lot of sort of weird stuff of this sort, and a less sect-like group is one that more nearly has the same rules as the surrounding society. And that there is a cost to these. And the cost is that you can't interact very easily outside of the group. And he argued that that tends to be a larger cost for high-skill, high-income professions than for low-skill, low-income professions. That if you are a doctor, only being able to have patients who are also Orthodox Jews is going to reduce your practice a good deal, ditto for a lawyer. There's going to be some market, of course, within such a community, but not huge. Whereas if you're a plumber, you don't need to have social interactions with people you work for. I guess plumbers do pretty well, but you could think of more low-skilled activities. So his prediction was that you would find a negative correlation between how sect-like a religious group was and how high the income of its members were. And that's, you know, it's not a very rigorous argument, but it's a testable argument, which is sort of nice to have. And his conclusion in this long-ago talk of his was that that pattern held with one notable exception, which was the Mormons, that the Mormons were both quite sect-like and had reasonably high incomes. And his explanation was that Mormons are very good at recruiting low-income people and turning them into high-income people. And I've wondered, I don't know if he looked at the black Muslims, at the Nation of Islam, but that I wouldn't be surprised if that were a similar pattern, where it's a group with a lot of restrictions, but a lot of what's going on, as far as I can tell, is taking sort of inner-city people coming out of a relatively dysfunctional culture and saying, all right, you don't drink, you don't sleep around, you work hard, our religion tells you all of these things, and it might turn out that similarly was a mechanism that took people who would normally be low-income. Yes?
So I guess your friend Larry's argument holds true about the origin of some of these laws that don't necessarily yield economic efficiency.
Yes.
Or high yielding products. The assumption is that the group that is developing these laws is functioning as a religious minority, so that it
yes.
creates boundaries
right.
against a
yes.
larger minority that's
yes.
not like the
yes.
a larger majority that's
yes.
not like the minority. So, what would be the how would he explain when these minorities eventually spread out and become predominant?
Or the other way around. Islam, after all, was a large fraction of the population of its area of the world.
Right.
I should say, Larry was really talking specifically about the U.S., because the puzzle he started, I really left out the beginning of his argument. The puzzle he started out with was, in the U.S., you have an open market for religions. There is nothing to keep somebody from starting a new religion. So why don't you find, so suppose you've got one of these religions that has a bunch of costly requirements. Why doesn't some splitter, some heretic, start a version of the religion that's got all the same characteristics minus the inefficient ones, and then draw people away? So why doesn't Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism attract everybody who is an Orthodox Jew, essentially, and similarly for all the others? And why don't they come into existence if they don't? So that was his initial puzzle. And his argument really was that there's a real advantage to being an Orthodox Jew or some one of these other things, namely that you're now part of such a community which engages in taking care of its members and which works for that reason. But no, I agree, it's not a very good explanation for, in particular, a majority religion having such restrictions. On the other hand, it's an interesting question, because if I think about the Islamic case, I guess prayer would be the main one, and maybe fasting. That in the case of Islam, the tax makes perfectly good sense. That basically, we'll come to that later, but there's a set of Quranic taxes, and they are tax. It's an interesting system, because at least in principle, they don't have to go to the government. In principle, what's going on is that you're obliged to have a certain amount of money, depending on... Basically, there's one rate for certain agricultural products from land that is irrigated, a higher rate for non-irrigated land, and a rate for commercial profits, essentially. So it doesn't apply to all forms of income. But what you're supposed to do is that you, as an individual Muslim, owe a certain amount each year. And you can, if you choose, give it to the ruler to distribute. You don't have to. You can distribute it yourself as long as you meet the requirements of what kind of people it's supposed to go to. And in three of the four schools, it's supposed to be divided up with a certain amount going to travelers who presumably need things, a certain amount to the poor, a certain amount to people who are fighting for Islam. I don't remember the whole list. And in one of the schools, you can divide it any way you like as long as it goes to people in that set, in that list of categories. So it's a system of a tax, but calling it a tax is a little bit misleading. You might almost call it obligatory charity in that sense. Now, you can see that that serves functions within that society, so that's not really a deadweight cost. Now, the fact that a believing Muslim can't eat or have sex in daylight for a month of the year, that being the fast of Ramadan, which I guess maybe it's just ended, I'm not sure, at least it was Ramadan not very long ago, looks like it's just a cost, and I'm not quite sure why you end up with that. Now, maybe part of the answer was at the very beginning of the religion, when they were very much a minority, that some separation of this sort worked. I don't know enough about the history of when that came in. The restrictions on food aren't very serious. You can't eat pork, and the food has to be slaughtered in a particular way, but I doubt that's a very costly requirement, though I don't really know. So I'm not really sure I know enough about Catholics, the not eating meat in Lent was pretty much functional in the sense that Lent is happening at a point when you're more or less running out of meat through the winter and you don't want to kill the stock that you've kept for breeding for the next year, so it probably wasn't a very costly requirement. There are also a bunch of fast days other than Lent, though, and I'm not sure where you couldn't eat meat or milk. I'm not sure. What? Well, that's the surviving one, but it was more complicated than that in the Middle Ages. Yeah.
It seems like a lot of these explanations they have user explanations in the sense that so a lot of these rules seem to promote some kind of character. So, I think when somebody says you can't eat the kid of the calf with this milk, yeah, it just seems like you're trying to discourage callousness, which is kind of taking the milk.
That explains the original rule, but it doesn't really explain why it then gets generalized to you can't have cheese with your hamburger.
Sure. But, for a lot of these rules, like the Ramadan fast.
It might be. You might argue, and a different argument would be to say that the Ramadan fast is teaching self-control. But there's another possibility, which I actually discuss in the chapter on Judaism, and that is that some of these rules are a way of telling whether people believe in their religion. Let me give you the Jewish example, which is one that struck me. I think you have a similar one in Islam. And that is that in Jewish law there are various legal situations in which you can win a law case by taking an oath. All right? Basically, I think you stole my cow, but I have very little evidence. If you're willing to swear that you didn't, you can swear and be free. The case is over. Reverse it, and I have quite a lot of evidence, and now you get to the point where I can swear and take. If I'm willing to swear the right oath, I win the case. This is a great system. It's a lie detector, provided people believe in the religion enough so they'll be very reluctant to swear falsely. And there's some evidence that they do. Some of the stuff I was reading on Islamic law at least claims that there were cases where people could have avoided capital punishment by the appropriate false oath and didn't, which suggested that those people at least believed in it enough so they're willing to stake their lives. And I don't know if it's true or not. This is somebody who's making an argument, but it's at least an interesting claim. So then the question is, how do we find out whether you believe in the religion? Well, one way is if the religion imposes some burdensome requirements on you, and we can more or less tell if you're making them. All right? Because if the religion says you've got to do A, B, and C, and by the way, we've noticed that you quite often don't do B when you think nobody is watching, then maybe we won't believe your oath. And at least in Jewish law, as far as I can tell, it seems to be pretty explicit that the two reasons for not letting somebody swear are either that he swore in the past and it turned out to be false, or that he's known to be an, I don't know how they put it, but basically an unreliable person, an untrustworthy person. So that's another interesting explanation of some of this. And you will notice that in the Gypsy law, there, the legal procedure of the Chris Romani that's being described, one thing that's happening is people taking appropriate oaths that they're telling the truth. The parties to the dispute taking oaths that they're telling the truth. And presumably, if they really believe in that somewhat odd religion, they'll be very reluctant not to to then lie, because I presume you become polluted in some form if you've taken the oath and lied. And you see the same thing, I should say, the Cheyenne, we're not covering this year, but in Cheyenne law, there are certain legal situations where you can basically swear, I think it's by the earth and the sky and the sun or something, that something is true, and they at least believe that if you swear falsely, one of those things is going to kill you in the next year or so. The sun will burn you up, or I don't remember what the details are. But you can see that in a lot of societies, it could be very useful to have people believe in a religion and to know if they believe in the religion, because you can then use the, and of course, in theory, we do it too, right? You're supposed to swear, I don't know how you swear on the Bible, is sort of the standard Western court, or at least Anglo-American courtroom system, and it presumably developed at a time when people were reluctant to swear on the Bible if it wasn't true, and I assume some people still are. Yeah.
What would be the usefulness of having the knowledge of who believed in the religion?
The particular case I was thinking of was for court disputes. If I want to know what, you say you're innocent, do I believe you?
Okay.
Well, if you swear you're innocent, may God strike me dead if it's not true, and I'm pretty sure you really believe in God, well, you're probably innocent.
Okay.
Right. So that's
the credibility.
That's right. It makes it possible. It's a lie detector.
Yeah.
It's in effect functions as a lie detector. The whole question, I'll go back a step, the whole question of lie detectors is sort of interesting. Something will come to, not for a while, but it's sort of interesting to think about, is the whole issue of testimony under torture. Because lots of societies have had it. You can probably argue that our society has had it covertly, even if not explicitly. And in Periclean Athens and in Rome, slaves could only testify under torture. All right? The only way you could use a slave as a witness is if you tortured him. And that seems sort of crazy, because the obvious answer is he'll say whatever you want him to say if you're torturing him. And I think the most plausible explanation, we'll come to this again a few other times because it's sort of an interesting issue that shows up, is that they believed that when somebody was under a lot of stress, a competent interrogator could tell whether he was making it up or not. And if you believe that, then torture makes some sense. We'll keep on torturing you until you tell the truth, and we can know when you're telling the truth. But it does depend on being able to distinguish a truth from a lie, which you're doing to get out of it. Let me give you my favorite solution to this problem. I don't think I mentioned it before. It's the Visigothic solution, which is that that's where you're torturing the defendant, not the witness, and that's where basically his confession has to match the description of the crime given by the accuser, and the assumption is he wouldn't know enough to do that unless he was guilty. So that was an actual attempt to do it, but it's a problem.
Doesn't that incentivize
Well, except that if he hasn't really committed the crime, he won't be able to confess, and you will get in trouble for making a false accusation. Now, he may get hurt, but he's not going to get executed. Now, what the limits are, I don't know. I believe it is, I'm pretty sure that von Gulick says that in Chinese law, if the defendant dies under torture without having been convicted, the official who's in charge of it is guilty of murder and is punished for it. I don't know whether it's capital or not, might be. But so that there's actually one of the Judge D stories, which is this quite neat game of chicken, as it were, between the judge and the defendant, where the defendant is guilty, woman, she's murdered her husband, she's also quite tough, and she is refusing to admit it, she is being tortured, and she is sort of making it obvious to the judge and the court people that they're going to get an awful lot of trouble if she dies without confessing. And it's quite an interesting story, because eventually the problem is solved not by her confessing, but by somebody else telling the judge how the crime was done. It's an undetectable murder. And it turns out that somebody else had also killed her husband in the same way and was therefore, in effect, giving up her own life in order to see justice done. So it's sort of a neat story. Yes. I think the answer is that you usually want a slave's witness against his owner. And the owner's in a position to put a lot of pressure on the slave if he betrays him. And that therefore the assumption is you need enough countervailing pressure to get this. But that's my guess. I don't think we have a source that tells us. I don't know of a source that tells us. But alright, so anyway, it's an interesting question. You're going to see these patterns in other places of ways in which different groups, and in particular, I think you may see it more, that's an interesting question, whether you see it more in the embedded legal systems, in the people like the Amish and the Gypsies, than you do in a dominant legal system. Because a dominant legal system doesn't have to isolate people in the same sense. I mean, there's nowhere to go, whereas the other ones do. And of course, one point which I think I raised before, with going back to the case of embedded legal systems, is that one reason you want to have barriers around your people is in order that expulsion becomes an effective threat. All right? If it's easy to go somewhere, then saying, we will have nothing to do with you, ha-ha, go play with somebody else. Whereas if you have been brought up in such a way that you see everybody else as horrible and they see you as horrible, then you've got a really effective threat against people. There's a discussion that you've already read about what these odd rules they have are, and then the question is, how is it enforced? So let me start with what's the simplest way in which rules like that are enforced? The simplest way in which the rules of cleanliness, so ritual cleanliness is what it really is, of pollution, why do people do the things that the rules tell them to do? What's the first, simplest reason? Yeah? That's the last reason. That's only what happens in the extreme case. Why don't you curse in public? I'm assuming you don't. Is it because you expect somebody to have a court case? That's certainly one of them. But there's even a step before that. So, I don't know about you, but I suspect there are quite a lot of people who wouldn't even curse in public if nobody was watching. Because they don't like it, right? So see, the very first level is you internalize the norm. That the first level is you say, if I did this, I'd be filthy and unclean like all those non-gypsies. And there's a second level related to that, which is not only to be filthy and unclean, but one result of being filthy and unclean is I'd probably get sick. Something would happen to me. There would be divine punishment. God would be angry at me, depending on the particular system. But that part of the belief structure, part of it is sort of a pure value thing. You shouldn't do this. But part of it is consequences. Part of it is the idea that doing this, something bad will happen to you. So that if you think for a moment, taking it a little further, about the fact that lots of societies have had laws against male homosexuality, and especially against sodomy. And part of that, I think, was the idea, if we have something so horrible in our culture, God will punish us. You know, that's what people at least take to be the Sodom and Gomorrah story. I gather there's a good deal of scholarly question as to whether that's really going on in that story, but at least it's an interpretation that was accepted. So that's a reason to impose those rules, but also on yourself. If you say, if I do what God doesn't want, something bad will happen to me, That's another reason. Then you come to yours, which is if I behave in this way, other people will think badly of me. Maybe they will actually punish me in some way. Maybe I'll just lose status. It'll be less likely that a man I want to marry will marry me, or that somebody will give me a job, or people will rent apartments to me, and so forth. Now, one of the things I wondered about, taking it away from the gypsies to sort of modern America, is that modern America, we have quite high crime rates in the inner city. And one of the questions is why. And one possible answer is that in functional societies, the main thing that prevents crime isn't the police and the court system. That the main thing that prevents crime is that if you're a thief, probably some of the people around you are going to know it. And they're not going to want you to date their daughter. And they're not sure they want to rent you an apartment. And. So that there may be a whole lot of sort of sub-legal, as it were, norm enforcement things, which in a well-functioning society work, and which break down in a society where a large percent of the population is on welfare or engaged in illegal activities or whatever. So I'm not sure it's right, but I've wondered if perhaps both lawyers and economists who do law overestimate the importance of the formal enforcement mechanism and underestimate the importance of the informal. Yep.
I was wondering if there was a correlation between the violence and the definition of things like apartments and the decline of society, because I found out recently that going from Egypt both had apartments, especially during the decline, and I was wondering if that was related to, you know, the fact that you can just move places.
You mean rental apartments rather than buildings with lots of apartments in them? Because I was thinking you could argue the other way around, that if you have a private house, nobody can observe what you're doing, whereas if you've got people on all sides of you, you'd better obey the rules or else somebody will catch you. So. Yeah, I just don't know enough about it, but it would be an interesting question, at least. So then one of the questions, which in a way goes back to something like Larry's point, is why is it stable? Why, if you have the belief that doing certain things are bad and make you unhappy, and if there are reasons to want to do those things, if you really like bacon, what maintains it? What keeps it from sliding away? And one answer might be what I sort of think of as the bootstrap solution, which is that not only will other people treat you badly if you violate the norms, but they believe that if they don't treat you badly for violating the norms, they'll be violating a norm and will get treated badly. So you've got a sort of self-consistency system, and just how sticky that is, I'm not sure. And of course, again, all of this keeps going. As you can also say, why do I refuse to associate the person who is marame or is violating the rules? One reason is that shows he's a bad person and therefore he might steal from me. Another reason is because it's contagious, because if I associate with that person, now I'm a norm violator and God will be angry or I'll get sick or things of that sort. So you have a lot of stuff of that general sort going on. How much of this is true of our society? All right? We've been thinking about this of exotic foreign societies, but to what extent do... Here's a question. How many people have views which they would be reluctant to state in public, not because they think they are wrong, but because they think people would think worse of them if they did? I'll raise my hand. All right? So in that sense, a lot of us are constrained by somewhat similar social mechanisms. I think it'd be pretty easy to make a short list of positions that are defensible, not necessarily true, but defensible, which in our particular society it would be imprudent to express a belief in. And what the list will be different for different people, obviously. And some of them might be self-enforced. That is, I suspect, probably less true now, but I suspect that not that long ago, there were people whose inclinations were homosexual, who repressed them not just because of external pressure, but because they felt that it was sort of a sinful, unclean, bad thing to do, and therefore you shouldn't do it. And probably still true, although I suspect less true now than it would have been 30 or 40 years ago, since that's become much more accepted. But you can think of other things. Think about the whole question of being a house husband. All right? I suspect that there are a fair number of men who would be reluctant. Suppose you and your wife are both capable of earning good income, And suppose you really like kids and she doesn't. There's, you know, she doesn't dislike them, but I just spent 2 days with my grandchildren. You know, it can be wearing after a while dealing with a 2-year-old. So I think a lot of people, both men and women, would be a little reluctant to reverse the traditional gender division of labor and to say the husband is going to stay home with the kids and the wife's going to earn money, because the husband, even aside from any external feelings, will feel, look, I've been a failure. Men are supposed to be able to support their wives. And the wife might say, well, you know, women are supposed to be raising children. And here, what kind of an incompetent woman I am. I can't raise my own children. I've got to have my husband do it. So there's a certain sense in which I think you have a noticeable amount of these things happening even in our society. And, of course, that's part of the fun of a course like this, is seeing to what extent you can generalize from weird foreign people who are obviously crazy to ourselves. Who we know are, of course, perfectly sane. All right. Let's go on to talk a bit about the structure. Actually, let me stop for a moment. Do you people have comments, questions? Yes?
I was wondering, like a culture, I thought of, with certain opinions on how to relate to people, but at the same time, certain behaviors, public behaviors that weren't really done before or really looked down.
That's an interesting one, yeah.
Those are things really good guys.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering why certain things change and others don't. And yeah. You have a look into that.
I don't know. But no, your tattoos are a very interesting one, because I would have said that when I was your age, for somebody of our social class to be tattooed would be seen as really weird. And for most people, it would, you know, not that there were sort of certain subsets. Maybe sailors have tattoos and some other groups, but it's not normal. Whereas my impression is that a whole lot of sort of, you know, college graduate type ordinary people in modern day America have tattoos on them now. And I don't know why that shifted. Yeah, you have a tattoo you're about to show us. Yeah. But it's also true of piercings. All right, that again, I think of things like a ring through the nose. Well, that's, you know, some exotic, maybe African tribe does that. Now it's true, rings through the ears were perfectly normal. That's an interesting case where when I was growing up, for women to have their ears pierced and have earrings, yeah, everybody does. Not everybody does that, but most people do that. But to have your nose pierced, yeah, maybe you're from India or you're from Africa or you're from some exotic foreign land, but it's not what we do, and I think it now increasingly is what we do. So, yeah, it's an interesting question how they change. I don't know. Opinions? Guesses? No? All right. One point about the book's discussion of the sort of social structure, organizational structure. The chapter you're reading, unless you look at the footnotes, you may miss the fact that a lot of what he's saying is really about only one subset of gypsies. That the whole Nazia, Compania, etc. is, I think, true of the Vlach Rom. The Vlach Rom are the Romanian, are the gypsies who were enslaved in Romania for 4 centuries. And they are, I think, by a sizable margin, the largest gypsy population as far as we know. And they're divided into 4 nations, 4 Nazia, which sort of self-identify, and I don't remember the names of them anymore. And they have the Chris Romani, which is this sort of court arrangement. It's clear the Roman Chal don't. It's clear, I think, that the Kale don't, the 2 other ones that are discussed in some detail in the book. And my guess is that a fair number of the other ones don't. Something also that I don't think got mentioned in the, at least in what you've read so far, but it's a little bit relevant on religion, is that the typical pattern is that gypsies adopt the local religion. But they, in addition, have their own set of pollution rules, so that there are Muslim gypsies in the Muslim world, there are Protestant gypsies in Europe, and I'm not sure, for all I know, there are Buddhist gypsies somewhere in India or China or someplace. But in any case, the discussion, I think, is heavily biased towards the Vlach Rom there. I mean, you've read the description, but basically you've got these sort of big, I guess, ethnic groups that call themselves nations, of which there are only 4. You then have individual households that are basically extended families at the bottom of the system, and then in between you've got 2 different structures. One of them is the clan, which is a group of not necessarily geographically together families who have some connection. I'm not sure, maybe maybe kinship, I'm not sure. I don't know if the clans are sort of all the descendants of the same great-grandfather or something, that some societies do it that way. But then you've got a compania, which is much more nearly a contractual rather than a kin-based system, which is households in the same general geographical area who are interacting with each other. Yeah?
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. And at least as they describe it, you've got the clan has a chief and a council of elders and a female sort of semi-chief that, and then the legal system is oral law, and that's sort of interesting too, because on the one hand, they think the oral law is well defined, but as you may have noticed, one of the things they apparently have a Chris for is to modify the oral law. That was a point which sort of mentioned in passing and then got dropped, but was interesting. And you might argue that oral law is more, we don't really know. It's not as if we have any detailed knowledge of what the oral law was 200 years ago, so we don't know how much it's changed. But you could certainly imagine that it could quietly change with nobody with nobody saying so. But in any case, the system seems to be that that within the single clan, the chief handles disputes, that across clans in a compania, I think, that you have an informal arbitration system, the divano, and that one doesn't have formal lawmaking or formal enforcement powers, but presumably has some social pressure. But then you've got the fancy system, which is the Chris Romani, and that's the one where there is a dispute, and one of the two parties asks for a court, as it were, a Chris Romani. And in this chapter, it sounds as though there's really one judge. And my memory, but I haven't reread the rest of the book yet, is that that's less clear in some of the other stuff. And I think, again, one of the problems in work like this is that you're generalizing about gypsies. And first, you're generalizing from the Vlach Rom to gypsies in general, but even among the Vlach Rom, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Vlach Rom in Romania are doing things somewhat differently from Vlach Rom in the United States, and maybe from the West Coast to the East Coast. It's not as if you've got a Supreme Court there, right? It's a system where, in effect, the local groups are sort of making their own rules. So one of the interesting points that I was noticing this time was the point that there were some cases where they had a Chris, which wasn't actually a lawsuit at all, but was people saying, look, we'd better change our traditional law in the law. Why do they have to, what's the pressure to change the traditional law? That was sort of intriguing. What are they worried about, at least according to the book, the particular example they gave? There may be others. Divorce law. The problem in general, as I've commented before, one of the problems that the gypsies face in North America is they're an intolerant society, which means that people can, to some extent, as it were, trade off between the official law and the group law. And they were worried that if you suppose you've got somebody who really wants a divorce and can't get a divorce under gypsy law, that might be an incentive to, in effect, leave the gypsy community, get a legal divorce in the U.S. courts, and go do other things. Now, you could also imagine, it isn't discussed, but I wonder if there's a possibility of splitting. You could imagine that if there are enough gypsies who don't like the rule, they could, in effect, make their own subset of gypsies, something much easier for the Amish, as it turns out, but it might happen for them. And I don't know. I haven't seen a discussion of that. But that's sort of an interesting question, to what extent you can keep a unified culture, as it were, and to what extent it keeps splitting. So in any case, the description here seems to imply that when it's all over, the judge or the judges make the decision, and some other things seem to imply that it's more nearly a consensus, and I'm not sure what is right. But it is clearly a procedure which is designed to lock out people who aren't part of the culture, because the whole procedure is not only in their language, it's in a specialized dialect of their language used for legal purposes. Anyway, so I'm not sure I have anything more to say about it, but maybe you do, but it struck me. Yeah.
I have a question, because to lock out the culture, that was also part of the book, and
I was wondering why you're like trying to really keep far away from the culture at Odysseus. But on the other hand, they just, for example, they call the last country where they have been as their nationality. Why is that?
Because they don't want to be identified as gypsies.
But why? I mean,
well, one reason is that gypsies have been the targets of a good deal of hostility, that after all, quite a lot of them were killed by the Nazis. The French government has been making considerable efforts to try to get gypsies out of France, not very successfully. If you think about the general situation of a group who are seen as foreigners within a country, it's always a little bit iffy. All right? There's English author who I rather like, G.K. Chesterton, who is sometimes accused of anti-Semitism. And if you, he's somebody who was writing early 20th century. And if you really read his stuff, you can read him as either a Zionist or an anti-Semite. Because what his basic argument is that you shouldn't pretend that Jews in England are Englishmen. And that on the one hand, that means that he suggests that perhaps the only restriction on Jews ought to be that they have to wear some odd kind of clothing so that we distinguish them. But he also is sympathetic to the idea that here we complain that they are bankers and things and don't work the land, but they aren't allowed to work the land. And so when they say, we give us some land of our own and we'll work it, that it's hard to deny it. So his point, again, it's sort of interesting because he's a pretty sympathetic writer at a point long before the Nazis, when the whole issue was much less emotionally loaded than it is now. And what he saw was not they are bad or good, but only they are different, and that matters. And I should say, he's somebody who on the whole is in favor of difference, in the sense that he was, if you read Chesterton, he sort of dislikes enormous nations. He has one of his novels, The Napoleon of Notting Hill, is one where in some future England, the little neighborhoods start functioning as independent countries, as it were, and eventually Notting Hill, which is a little part of London, sort of conquers England, as I remember. I don't remember the tales. I read it a long time ago. But so it's not, saying people are different, at least for him, is not a condemnation. It's more or less an observation. But you can see that it's dangerous. I mean, the Nazis are the extreme case, but in general, there was a footnote in this book which discussed one case in which it sounded as though a gypsy community a few decades ago was very badly treated by the local police. And why? Because who's going to stand up for these people? Everybody knows they're sort of weird foreigners. So I think if you look at what's going on, a good deal of the way that the gypsies protect themselves is by staying below the radar. And sounds like a pretty sensible strategy on the whole. One of the points that the book makes, which I thought was an interesting one, was the difference between adaptation and assimilation. All right, so you have an odd group within a larger culture, and one response is to say, let's become like them. That's assimilation. And that, on the whole, is what American Jews have done. All right, that I was struck a long time ago, I was traveling in Europe, and I was in, I think, a youth hostel kind of place. And I was sitting at a table with a bunch of people about my age. I was probably in my early 20s or something. And we were chatting. And one of them asked me what I was or where I was from. I said, I'm an American. Where are you from? And they gave me very unlikely answers. I had a feeling they were pulling my leg. And so one of them said, can you show me your passport? And I showed him my passport. And he looked at my passport. And then he said, well, I'm French. The same way you're American, and he's German, and he's Italian. They were all Jewish. And to them, that was a much bigger difference than it was to me. All right? That to them, what they meant was they weren't really French and Italian and German. Whereas I do think of myself as an American. And that's a case where in America, American Jews, there's some small communities like some of the extreme Orthodox that really haven't assimilated, but mostly most American Jews are mainly part of American culture, not mainly. My parents, I remember asking me long after I was an adult whether they should have brought me up more nearly in Jewish culture, and I said I preferred to have been brought up in the religion they really believed in, which is roughly speaking 18th century rationalism. Not Judaism, because neither of them was a believer either. My grandparents would have believed in the religion. But assimilation is one strategy. But there's a different strategy, and the different strategy is to say, how can we stay different but protect ourselves from them? And that's, I think, what I take to be adaptation. Now, one way is you avoid doing whatever things will most get you in trouble with them. So that, for example, it sounds as though gypsies in America are less likely to marry off their daughters at 11 than they would have been in the old country 100 years ago. But another way is you play games with the ways in which they identify you in order to make it harder for them to keep track of you. You don't tell them you're gypsies. Maybe you're a little bit ambiguous what your name is. I was reading something not long ago which was arguing that one of the things that happened as nation states were becoming more powerful in Europe was forcing people to have last names. Because it's real hard to keep track of people if there are 73 people named William in the town. Now, of course, it's almost impossible to keep track of people in this faculty because, as you know, all male professors at Santa Clara University are named David. I mean, I take it as evidence they were really happy with hiring me, so they just hired Davids. Means that at a faculty meeting, whenever anybody says David, my reaction is that's not an identifier in this population. But in any case, you can see that making people have last names and first names, it now becomes easier to have a list of who they are, to say, have you paid your taxes, how old are you, shouldn't you be going into the army with our draft? And in fact, interesting digression, it used to be said, I don't know if it still is, that there was some part of, I think, the Caucasus, inside Russia, what was Russia, was Soviet Union, where people lived an extraordinarily long age. And there were various theories about what special things they ate that let them live to 120. And I gather what was really going on was that the standard device for draft evasion in that society was to adopt the persona, the name, of an older relative no longer alive, who had already served in the army. And that way you didn't get drafted, but that also meant that your paper age was 30 years older than your real age, and so the record showed you as dying at 130. I don't swear the story is true. I think I mentioned to somebody earlier my general rule of thumb to distrust all historical anecdotes that make good enough stories to have survived on the literary merit. But it might well be true. And in any case, it's a good story. As they say in Italian, si non è vero è ben trovato. So... let's see. What else? Where was I after getting into too many digressions? So what are the sanctions that the CRIS can impose? Probably they include capital punishment, although if so, they're probably pretty quiet about it. Fines, which are apparently paid by the lineage, and ultimately marame, ultimately pollution and banishment. And if you look at the different societies with banishment, how powerful it is depends a whole lot on the alternatives. So that in Athenian law, we'll come to later, if you are accused of a capital offense, you have the option, I think after the first day of the trial, of simply accepting banishment instead. If you don't do that, you might end up getting executed. In Cheyenne law, as I mentioned, if you kill another Cheyenne, you are banished. But in all of those cases, there are places to go. All right, Athens was one of a bunch of Greek city-states, and you could easily enough, I mean, there were lots of foreigners in Athens, there were lots of Athenians who could be foreigners elsewhere, so, yeah.
Is exile for Athens good for colonies?
To what extent did Athens have colonies? Athens had an empire eventually.
Yeah,
but it was an empire.
All the Greek city-states founded colonies in, you know, Asia Minor or something
like that. I think those were independent states. I'm pretty sure they were I may be mistaken, but I think in both Italy and Asia Minor, that it's true that you have cities planted by the Greeks from Greece, both in Italy, especially southern Italy, and in Asia Minor. But I think that those are normally independent cities. After all, think about Syracuse, which is the big example in Italy. Syracuse fights a war with Athens, the Athenians fight a war with Syracuse, which is a catastrophe for the Athenians, as it turns out. That's their great defeat. So pretty clearly, the Syracuse didn't consider itself a colony of any of the Greek city-states. So I think those were independent. Now, Athens created an empire, but it was an empire that was theoretically a voluntary league of alliance, which they gradually made less and less voluntary over time. So I don't think that issue would arise. And in the case of the Cheyenne, it sounds, at least from the book Cheyenne Law, which you aren't reading because I'm not doing it this year, as though there were were other tribes who were reasonably friendly with the Cheyenne, I guess spoke languages they could understand. I'm not sure of the details. And so it wasn't all that uncommon that somebody's exiled and comes back 10 years later with a horse loaded with tobacco and says, I'd like to give my tribesmen lots of tobacco if they'll let me back in, basically. It seems to have been a fairly common pattern. Bribing the voters was not considered evil. The Amish case, the Amish are closely related to the Mennonites. They basically came out of the same heresy, which was the rejection of infant baptism. They're all Anabaptists, ultimately, in their origin. And therefore, if you are completely thrown out of Amish culture, you can always join the Mennonites, and some of them do. But furthermore, the usual rule is that if you get, in effect, expelled from your congregation, the Amish view congregations as higher or lower. Now, I should say low is a positive term to the Amish, that they are in favor of humility. And so lower means stricter, that a higher congregation is one which has fewer restrictions on its people and a lower one with more restrictions. And if you are a member of a relatively low group and they say you violated our rules, you've refused to stop violating our rules, so we're going to ultimately take the final step, to exile you from our group, you may still be accepted by another higher, more tolerant group. So they have. So again, in effect, the sanction is a sanction that costs something because it means the people, your own friends and relatives and such, are no longer part of them. But it's not nearly as serious as if there's nobody who you fit with who will take you, which seems to be the traditional gypsy situation. Let's talk a little bit about the ways in which the gypsy legal system is interacting with the host system, with the U.S. system, for example, which is what he's mostly discussing. I don't know much about others. How would gypsy law, and I wanted you also to think about the Islamic case, because as you may know, another controversy over in modern America over Islam is people say, look, they're trying to impose Sharia on American law, Canadian law, and they make the same. English, all of those, you have this horror of the idea that somehow Sharia is sneaking in spite of their being whatever they are, 5% of the population, they're going to take over and we're all going to have our hands cut off or something. And what are the ways in which a legal system like one of those ends up interacting with the dominant legal system? And one way, of course, is that it doesn't, that it just does its own stuff below the radar. But you're an American judge. How might you want to take account of state gypsy law? Problem shows up in your court. Yep.
You're not going to, typically. I mean, you're going to impose American law on the controversy and resolve it. You may take some sort of cultural influence into account, and maybe that'll come in sentencing and imposing a penalty if they were within their cultural norms. But for the most part, you are bound by American law, and so are they.
On the other hand, if you're thinking about a civil rather than a criminal issue, you might have the option of trying to use their system as arbitrators. And, of course, that isn't limited to religious cases, that after all, in our legal system, out-of-court settlements are perfectly legal, and therefore one possible option, and one which you also see in other societies, would be to say, all right, if you wish, you may go to your court, and if that produces a result that the two of you are satisfied with, then that finishes the case.
Where is that court?
Well, it's going to be much harder with the gypsy case than the Islamic case because it's less explicit a court. But you could certainly imagine saying, you two have a dispute. Neither of you has done anything that results in criminal punishments, but maybe one of you owes damages to the other. Why don't you summon a Chris Romani or... Presumably the judge may or may not know enough about the gypsies to be able to know what he's doing, that you could certainly imagine the possibility of the judge saying, go to your ethnic group's dispute resolution mechanisms, and if they solve the problem, come back and tell me, and I'll put my stamp of approval. But, of course, they can't force you to go along. Or at least I won't let them force you to go along. Maybe they can without my doing it. Yeah.
But it seems there already someone is bringing the suit in the court. That system has already failed, right? Because they could have resolved it. That's the first kind of thing that they would have tried, presumably.
Maybe, but I guess it has to depend on the case. You could certainly imagine one where it started in the court, where it was harder to get to where calling a Chris is sort of a last-ditch kind of thing within that system. Yes?
Just in response to that, I think they talk about how sometimes the Roma would use the jury or the state's law enforcement kind of a way to get their attention.
That's right. That's one of the other interesting bits. I was thinking of sort of the interaction with interesting in a bunch of different ways. And that one of them, sort of the most attractive way, as it were, is that the overlaw system says, well, all right, you people can settle your disputes yourself, and as long as it doesn't break our law, it's all right. But in the other direction, it was reminding me of what I had mentioned earlier about the Somali, namely taking advantage of the overlaw system for your own purposes, so that one of the things you could do is to say, well, all right, we have decided to condemn you in our system. You're a fellow gypsy. You aren't willing to go along. We've decided that you owe him $1,000 compensation for what he did. We're going to find you polluted and have nothing to do with you, and you say, to hell with it, I don't care about you people. Well, the next thing we do is report you for assault or theft or rape or some offense to the mundane authorities. And we got lots of people who are willing to lie about it because we're a fairly homogeneous group. You're the outsider. None of us want to help you. So you could go to jail. But on the other hand, if you would just pay the damages that we've adjudged, we'll stop complaining. We'll drop our complaints. So you could certainly imagine ways in which they're gaming taking advantage of, just in the case, I don't know if people remember, the case I mentioned for the Somali law was where one group wants to attack another. In northern Somalia, when it was nominally under British rule. So what they do is they send a message or a leak or something to the British authorities saying there's going to be trouble here. But they time it so that the British authorities will show up after they've attacked and before the counterattack. And will thus prevent the counterattack. And you can see that as sort of an interesting element, and that's really analogous to what I were describing here, where you're treating them, the authorities, not as it were having any superior authority, but they're just one of the players in the game, one of the things you can use in trying to do what you're doing. But you can see that in some ways a group like the Gypsies has a real advantage, because if everybody associated with a certain problem is willing to lie on behalf of their friends, as it were, it's going to be hard to use the nominal legal system against them, and might be really easy for them to use the system. Now, that wouldn't have to be limited to that type of group. One of the interesting puzzles, incidentally, in the modern world is why you sometimes have particular small industries dominated by a single ethnic group. I think the case I saw discussed was, I think, Los Angeles donut shops, if I remember. And I don't remember anymore what they were, but it was some moderately obscure, I'm trying to remember, but I forget what it was. And one wonders if part of what's going on in these situations is that the ethnic group has its own mechanisms for dealing with certain kinds of problems which work better than the overlaw's mechanisms. And therefore, since the people in this industry are mostly interacting with each other, that the donut shops are buying from the same suppliers and they're hiring people from each other and so forth and so on. So if they've got good internal mechanisms for the equivalent of law enforcement, that could give them a real advantage over outsiders who aren't part of that group. Interesting possibility. One of the things that occurred to me, hadn't occurred to me before, is that the gypsies may be threatened by modern technology. Because one part of their tactic is doing their best to avoid letting the over-society easily identify who's who. Well, as we get better face recognition technology and virus scans and genetic testing, and you can pretty easily imagine that in another decade or two, various forms of kind of what the term is used for basically biological identifiers, the ID cards that you carry in your body, might be good enough so that a government that wanted to could, in effect, tag every gypsy, could say, all right, next time you show up, yeah, you're the guy who was in that case there, and we don't care if you say your name is now Jones instead of Smith. So what's people's reactions to not just the gypsy case? Is that it, would it be a gooder, suppose somebody has a technology which does really cheap and highly reliable DNA scanning. So what does it do? We've already got fingerprint scanning, we've got face recognition, none of it all that reliable, but suppose we've got something. So all we've got to do is get a couple of skin cells off your finger, and we know exactly who you are. Good or bad thing? Or both? What?
Depends on the situation.
A modern day America.
Yeah, a modern day America.
You want it. So you can press a button that makes that technology either exist or not exist. Would you press it?
I would not press it.
Because?
Because I just think it, it enables the government to, invade our privacy more often. I mean, like, I don't want someone to know that I'm at Safeway at 7 p.m. after class or something. You know, like, I would rather just that be my own private life. I would rather not be DNA scanned.
You're giving me a conclusion, but I'm not quite sure I know the reasons. And I think it's an interesting question, because a lot of us have this gut feeling that privacy is a good thing. And when you try to figure out why, it's not entirely clear. I'm not saying nothing that isn't. I've got, if you look on my webpage, I've got some published stuff on this. And at one point, I agreed to write a chapter for a book in defense of privacy, where I was writing in defense of privacy against somebody else who was against it. And you can make arguments, but they're not all that clear arguments, because after all, part of your privacy is your ability to scam other people. All right? Part of your privacy is the woman who you want to marry not finding out you're already married. Or not finding out what happened to your last three wives. Those are also part of privacy. The person you want to borrow money from, not knowing that there are three people chasing you around as a deadbeat. That's part of your privacy too. And of course the other side of it is just think how useful. I wouldn't have to worry about being afraid I lose my driver's license. Right now if I'm traveling, and every once in a while I think, well wait a minute, if somebody picks my pocket, how am I going to get home? How can I identify? Well, with this new technology, just put my finger into the ATM and it gives me money. Put my finger into the airport scanner and says, oh yeah, he's a reliable guy. He's not on the no-fly list. Yep.
Well, it depends on what you value more than convenience or privacy, perceived crime safety or privacy.
There are a whole bunch of things in both directions. That's right. There's an element of convenience, being able to prove who you are when you want to prove it. There's the degree to which you are afraid that the government or somebody else will use the information against you. That there's the reason that I'm inclined to think of it especially as a government problem is that you can defend yourself against private aggressors by having as much force as they do. Whereas the government has overwhelming force, and therefore maybe the only way, or at least one of the few ways of protecting yourself from a government is not to give them the information they need in order to know who to target. I mean, that would be one version from those people who are seriously suspicious of governments for why you care about privacy. But as I say, it goes the other way as well, because other people's privacy could be a danger to you because it could let them threaten you because you don't know what you have to know. You know, you wouldn't have let hired that person to take care of your kids if you knew what the record was of the last kids they took care of, that kind of thing. So it actually does go both ways. Yes?
Also, I'm wondering to what extent some of those private mechanisms can be done without law. And then on the flip side, we do have a record of a lot of technologies being used. I mean, like the pre-computer part of things were used in the European technology.
There's a sense in which technologies make it easier to do things, and that's good if the things you're doing are things we want you to do, and bad if the things you're doing are things we don't want you to do. And it's hard to predict. I was going to point out for a moment that we are also under a system of private laws. I presume, though I don't know any of the gory details, that there are things you could do that will get you expelled from Santa Clara University. All right, that's a system of private law. And that's a system of private law, if you think about its interaction with state law. From one side, it's like the Maramé sentence by the gypsies. From the one side, it's not that the Santa Fe University has the right to arrest you. They just have the right to do things they've got a right to do, namely not let you be a student here, and they can use that threat to punish sufficiently bad behavior. All right, if any of you are planning to download your papers for this class off the internet, I advise you not to, because it could have bad consequences. But on the other hand, imagine that you're expelled and you say, well, to hell with it, I'm going to come into class anyway. At this point, the university does depend on state law. They depend on the fact that you're engaged in trespass, and at that stage, they could arrest you. So there's an interesting kind of interaction between a private law system, of which we're all a part of, it's true of me as well as of you, and a public law system, that partly the private law system acts within the same constraints everybody else faces, and but partly it also depends on it. Let me raise sort of a complete tangent, but one of the ways of thinking about the gypsies, because there's a discussion in the... What I don't like, I should say, about that chapter and the editor's stuff in general is that I think he's too defensive of the gypsies. That, you know, I have no objection to saying they're a functioning society like any other, but he's more worried than I would be about people thinking badly of them. And, you know, at some point it gets sort of silly when he says, well, they could say that we're illiterate because we don't speak their language. But, of course, the reason we say they're illiterate is not because they don't speak English, which they do. It's because they don't have a written language. That is, Romani doesn't have a written, hasn't traditionally had a written form. But on the other hand, and anyway, the one of the questions, though, as he raises is, are they in some sense primitives? And it occurred to me that one way you might try to imagine them is that they're really hunter-gatherers. It's just that we're the population that hunter-gatherers in on, right? That ordinary hunter-gatherers are, you know, killing deer and gathering stuff, and they're gathering wealthy by doing fortune-telling and maybe stealing a few chickens if you go back to the traditional view of the gypsies and so forth. But they may be, in some ways, a structure more like hunter-gatherer bands than they are post-agricultural societies, which, if that's right, and I don't know enough about to really say, is sort of an intriguing way of thinking about them. Other things worth mentioning. There's some more stuff about how they, in effect, defend themselves from the standard system, such as providing a substitute convict, saying that, you know, we can't afford to have you arrest the chief of our clan, who's the guy who really did something that's illegal, so his son will confess to the crime instead, and he will earn lots of credit with the rest of us by spending a couple of years in jail, and he will then get out and be an important person because he's sacrificed himself for the group. So that's an interesting kind of way that, again, a close-knit society can maintain itself. And I don't know. It's sort of, it's interesting if you imagine sort of writing a work of fiction. Suppose you were on the other side of the game. Suppose you are the authority of the overlaw who doesn't want them to do all these things. And I don't know how would you sort of pull it apart? How would you somehow get them informing on each other? Or maybe you couldn't. I mean, maybe their system is really stronger than the formal system. I'm not sure. Other things of interest. Oh, I wanted to go, something that's really relevant to Islamic law, not here, but going back to the question of Sharia in modern courts. There's a sense, of course, in which not only Sharia is enforceable in modern courts, but German law is enforceable in American courts, and French law is enforceable in American courts, and Japanese law, right, you ought to all know about this, that if you imagine that I've signed a partnership agreement in some foreign country, and then there's a dispute in the U.S., the U.S. court is going to try to figure out what that agreement was under the law where it was signed and try to enforce that rather than what it would have been if it was done here. And so if you think about the obvious issue, which is marriage, how does a U.S. court handle a marriage that occurred under a legal system very different from ours? Well, within some range, it says, we don't care about your system, we have ours. So if you're married to three women, which you certainly can be under Islamic law, and you show up in the U.S., they will say, well, pick one. The other two are no longer married to you. Now, at the moment, that's more or less a irrelevant restriction, since we have essentially no restrictions on non-marital sex. There's nothing to keep you from treating them as wives, even though they legally aren't. But that wouldn't have been true 40 years ago, say. And there are going to be other cases. But if you end up with a divorce with one of them, then you're going to have a real problem of figuring out what the relevant law is. Right. I think that's roughly, we're roughly out of time. So read the next chunk and take some notes on what you want to talk about so I don't have to add all the conversation. You're supposed to be providing a reasonable share of it. Anything else occur to you? People who are doing SOAR papers ought at some point to bring me the form I'm supposed to sign. People that are doing non-SOAR papers are supposed to be figuring out what interesting things they're going to do papers about and tell me about it. If you are doing a non-SOAR paper, you have no obligation to write an outline, but if you feel like writing an outline and sending it to me, I will look at it and see if I can think of useful ideas that haven't occurred to you, and stuff like that. All right? So, see all of you Thursday. And my office hours are Tuesday at noon, and other times by arrangement.